TexasObserver.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Observer's writers to take a brief break from stringing together brilliant copy and say things to you on the internet instead. This week, we're joined by Observer editor Dave Mann. Hey, Dave.
Hello.
We've also got staff writer Patrick Michaels.
Hi.
And staff writer Melissa Del Bosque. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Each week on Observer Radio, we spend a little bit of time talking about stories that are currently in the news. Starting this week off is a story about a man who will just not eat green eggs and ham, but will read it to the American public. I'm talking, of course, about Ted Cruz. Dave Mann, I have one question and one question only. What does Ted Cruz really want?
Well, that's the interesting question right now, and I don't think it's entirely clear what he wants. I think we know that he's using his skills very effectively. I mean, you got to give the guy credit. He, you know, in the span of a year has risen to become one of the most widely known Republicans in the country. The guy is a household name. Everybody seems to be talking about him. And it's easy to forget that a year ago at this time, he wasn't even in office yet and had never been in any elected office. And as recently as 2 years ago, hardly anybody knew who he was. You know, he'd been Solicitor General of Texas, and a few people on the right were talking about him running for office, but no one was really giving him much of a chance. And now, a couple of years later, this guy is driving the conversation to Washington and driving the conversation in national politics. And to have that fast a rise, you know, that meteoric rise in national politics is incredibly difficult and pretty rare. I mean, Barack Obama is the one name that kind of comes to my mind of someone who kind of rose that quickly. But I think you have to give Cruz a lot of credit for you know, capitalizing on his debate skills, on his smarts, on recognizing where there's an opportunity to be like the intellectual of the right wing and capitalize on any kind of publicity opportunity. I mean, the guy has got a nose for publicity like you wouldn't believe. Hence the 21-hour filibuster or pseudo-filibuster or talkathon, whatever you want to call it.
So I was going to ask, is it fair to make a direct comparison to Wendy Davis on this one?
That's a good question. I think a lot of people are making that comparison because here are two Texans filibustering or talking about issues they care about and, you know, taking a stand in a fight they're probably going to lose. But I think there's some key differences. One being, you know, Wendy Davis was trying to filibuster a bill that was actually being debated. Ted Cruz was pseudo-filibustering a bill that has already passed and passed 3 years ago. And the analogy would be more like Wendy Davis coming back in the 2015 session and filibustering the Texas budget and holding it hostage until Republicans repealed the abortion law. That would be the Wendy Davis analogy. So I think, I mean, there are some similarities in that they both talked a long time and they're very passionate about their issue. But in terms of where they are in the legislative process, there are some real differences. But what does Ted Cruz want? Does he want to be president? Does he want the GOP nomination? Does he just want to be the hero of the Tea Party? I don't think we know that yet. I think we'll find out in the next few months.
But why can't Ted Cruz just have it all? I've been saving that one the whole time.
From there, we go to a story Melissa is reporting on about killings by Border Patrol agents. Melissa, can you fill us in?
Sure. Yeah. This just recently, we finally got a long-awaited report that a lot of civil rights advocates have been waiting for from the Department of Homeland Security Office of Inspector Generals. In the last 3 years, there's been 20 fatal shootings or beatings at the hands of Border Patrol. And I don't think any of those folks were even carrying any kind of weapon or anything like that. So there's been this outcry from lots of people about this excessive use of lethal force. And it was sort of at an impasse until PBS Need to Know aired their documentary, and they had uncovered this footage showing Anastasio Hernandez being brutally beaten and killed by border agents at the Tijuana-San Diego border on the U.S. side of the border. And the footage was so shocking that 16 congressional leaders demanded that U.S. Customs and Border Protection review its use of lethal force, and they also called for reform. So they
produced a report.
Yeah, and the congressional leaders requested this in April of 2012 after this footage was revealed, and the footage was taken by a woman who was an American citizen who was coming back from Tijuana after spending a day there when she heard Anastasio screaming for help and saw that the agents weren't leaving him alone. So she began filming with her telephone. So finally, these reports have come out, and they advocates say it's a step in the right direction, but they're not entirely convinced that there's going to be a serious change in the culture at U.S. Customs and Border Protection. So they'd like to see more. Right now, what the report points out, and then Customs and Border Protection made an announcement on Wednesday that absolutely, lethal force can never be used unless they're being threatened with a weapon or, you know, the bodily harm to the agent. So they're talking about how they need a clear use of force policy, and they want to review and enhance their current training. So they're trying to make concerted steps towards cutting down on these fatal shootings and beatings, which is a good thing, but a lot of advocates are not entirely convinced yet that it's going to happen.
Well, finally, let's go to Patrick, who is currently working on a piece about the TEA and the state's accountability system. Patrick, what's the scoop?
Yeah, so it's an interesting time for the State Education Agency, because there was a report that just came out sort of blasting them for their inability to catch the big cheating scandal happening in El Paso. TEA actually investigated what was going on twice and said everything was kosher. And then the feds came in and said, no, it's not.
Everything is not kosher.
Everything is not kosher. It's decidedly not kosher. And they locked up the superintendent of the school district in federal prison, and everyone got fired. And a whole bunch of other school districts got roped into this thing in El Paso. There are investigations around the state stemming from this thing, that the people who were working there and kind of in this culture may have transplanted some of those practices into other districts. And basically the game was to fix the your test scores for the schools to make it look like you were doing much better than you actually were, and you'd get a better rating from the state or from the federal government, and maybe your superintendent gets some performance bonuses. So that's what's going on around the state. My story is looking at one kind of interesting wrinkle in that, which is something that was never really investigated in El Paso, but seems like it was going on, where certain students' tests were being sort of thrown out and not counted to the school ratings, and that was one of the things that was helping them look a lot better than they really were. And if you look at the way that they were doing those things, it seems like there are some similar patterns in other school districts just all around the state in the last at least 5 years. It turns out this is something that TEA had been looking for a really long time, but lately, in their sort of much smaller incarnation that they have now, they just haven't been doing. TEA says they have ways of kind of looking for anomalies in the data that would spot these things, but there's no evidence that I can find that they actually have looked into any of these.
And I assume that the schools had some sort of justification for throwing these tests out?
Right. So some of what they can do is they can say, oh, well, this student was absent, or something happened on test day. We had a fire drill, or the kids all threw up on their tests, or whatever reason. there's protocol for if a student throws up on their test, like, how are you supposed to handle it?
I really wish I had known that.
There's the big red plastic bag in the corner that you put it in. You,
right.
You know, send it off to Pearson. So anyway, but some schools use these exemptions just a whole lot more than anyone else. You'll have, some schools, for instance, the ones that are, like, the most interesting are where they claimed, like, 7 exemptions 1 year and then, like, 30-some the next year. And coincidentally, that's the year in which their rating from the state went up as well. It's a fairly complicated thing. It's hard to spot. Which is one of the reasons why school districts may just be getting away with it for so long.
Cool. Well, thanks for sharing those stories, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Joining me now is Greg Harmon, who just very recently published an article called Wasteland, Frio County Struggles with Fracking's Leftovers. Greg, can you give us a little rundown about what that story is about?
Sure, you bet. This was a story that I first became aware of a few months back when I was hearing about kind of like this community or a couple communities down Dilley and Pearsall and in Frio County that we're seeing, you know, a disproportionate share, I guess you'd say, of disposal wells going in that, you know, energy companies from throughout the, I guess now 30 county Eagle Ford shale play were using to inject deep underground their wastewater, salt water, basically the flow back that comes out of the well once you do frack a well. And there's now, I think, 20 disposal wells in Frio County. Half of those are commercial wells, so basically any company from throughout, you know, the region can come in and get access. And what's interesting about Frio County being targeted in this way is that there's very little actual production that's going on as far as oil and gas production in the Eagle Ford zone in Frio County. So residents down there are, you know, though, you know, a good number of them have found jobs within the oil field, you know, they're driving outside of the county to those jobs. They come home and what they've got are, you know, a massive amount of trucks driving day and night to these sites, you know, bringing the trash of the Eagle Ford. So there's a lot of unease, to put it mildly, among, you know, local residents and you know, community leaders, county officials.
And is that because the people in Frio County feel like they're not getting the full benefit that perhaps other counties in the Eagle Ford Shale are getting?
I'm sure that's I'm sure that plays a factor. I mean, we're not hearing similar complaints in, you know, in Karnes County so much, you know, where there, which is really one of the hot spots of the Eagle Ford, you know, play. Folks there are well aware that they're not getting kind of like the tax revenues, they're not getting the leases, the, you know, landowners there are not getting rich in the way their neighbors are,
right.
But what they're getting are, you know, options on, you know, on a trash pit, basically.
And so this is like the concentration of where these wastewater dumps are, right?
Yeah, I mean, years back when things first started getting going, my understanding from, you know, I guess I should back up and say, you know, last Wednesday, I went out with a sheriff's deputy out of Jim Wells County. He came up there. He was asked to come up to Frio County and train deputies there on how to police, you know, these disposal wells and the enormous number of trucks that are now driving through these communities. I think the current count or the estimate for 2013 will be over 350,000 truck trips, you know, going in and out of the county.
Wow.
A lot of back roads, farm-to-market roads, county roads, you know, a lot of these are gravel roads. So there's a huge amount of truck traffic. The waste stream itself, county officials estimate over 750% increase in the last couple of years. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of activity there. And what's interesting is, you know, so this deputy came up, his name is Hector Sertuche, and he came up from Jim Wells County to train these folks. And the officers there basically were unaware they had the authority to enforce state, you know, environmental laws, specifically, you know, aspects of the state water code. And we're pretty enthusiastic to go at it. I mean, this is the latest, I guess you could say, expression of the community's concern over this waste stream. County officials, they've had public hearings. I went down in July to a public hearing where folks, you know, expressed to a representative from the Railroad Commission and a member of the TCEQ their concerns over the lack of oversight that's gone along with this. The county judge, Judge Garcia, has met with most recently with the head of TxDOT, concerned that, you know, because they're not getting the you know, this the revenue stream from oil production, they're not getting funding then for, you know, for roadway, you know, preservation, maintenance, disaster response, and some of those things.
Sure,
so
sure.
There's a number of different things that they're trying to do, but I don't think they've hit on any magic, you know, answer yet. This kind of crackdown, I guess you would say, on truckers is the latest one. But, you know, that was a one-day training with, you know, three officers. You know, they do have a couple new guys coming on to the force, and a lot of enthusiasm about this, and so we'll see what happens. In Jim Wells County, at the start of the Eagleford, you know, explosion, Azartute said that they saw a pretty quick compliance, you know, among the trucks. He spoke of, you know, just camping out at some of these waste pits and just, you know, as the trucks came in, you know, they'd say they mislabeled, they weren't on the manifest, they weren't permitted to dump there, and they were leaking, you know, a lot of these trucks. And pretty much we saw the same thing in Frio County when I went out with the deputies on Wednesday.
So what does this look like now for the deputies who are now trained and are now enforcing these laws?
Well, I mean, it's at the root, I guess, it's pretty simple. I mean, when you go out in the field, to begin with, none of them really knew they had, you know, like I said, they didn't know they had the authority. They expect, and the drivers themselves were like, you know, wait a minute, you know, I deal with TxDOT, I deal with, you know, Highway Patrol, or they, you know, they're talking about this, the state level, you know, oversight. But, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, whether it's TCQ or the Railroad Commission, I mean, you know, at that level, you're talking about civil penalties, you're talking about administrative fines, you're not talking about criminal prosecution or tickets being issued, you know, or arrests being made. That responsibility, as I understand it, and as these deputies, you know, were informed last week, that really falls down to the local level. So, you know, if you've got in your community folks with the local PD and the county who are trained, they understand, you know, the basics of, you know, state, you know, like in this case, the water code, you know, you can start, you know, pushing compliance pretty quickly. You could, you know, have people in handcuffs in jail if that's where it leads.
Right.
And so I think they were feeling really empowered, you know, having that information. It was interesting also, so I have to say, to pull up to the sheriff's office, and the first thing I saw was a Chesapeake, you know, private security truck. And I asked, you know, one of the deputies, I said, well, you do work pretty closely with Oilfield Security. And the response was, well, you know, we're oil field security, basically.
Right.
You know, a lot of these guys are sidelining, moonlighting, doing this work. And so they just, you know, the company leaves the truck there. They get off working, you know, for the county, and, you know, and they're off in the Chesapeake truck. So a lot of them are, you know, working both sides and making good money doing that, I have to say. And so we'll see, you know, long term, you know, what kind of motivation, you know, they have to do these kinds of investigations and enforcement actions.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, no, thanks. It was a pleasure. I've enjoyed speaking with you.
Joining me now is Joe Nick Petoskey, who recently wrote the liner notes for three reissues of Rocky Erickson's solo career. Rocky Erickson, of course, was the lead singer of 13th Floor Elevators. Mr. Petoskey, can you give us a rundown on Rocky Erickson?
Well, Rocky is one of the most important figures in Texas popular music, I think, when you look at the latter 20th century and on into the 21st century, and certainly his groundbreaking work that he did with the 13th Floor Elevators in the 1960s, many argue, and can make a good argument, the Elevators started in Austin with Rocky and in Houston, recorded in Houston, and they may be the very first psychedelic band.
The very first one.
Yeah, I mean, some people will argue this point, and there's some hedges and fudges, but the fact of the matter is they were in San Francisco in exile in 1966, which was the summer before the Summer of Love, when everything kind of broke out in San Francisco. They were pioneers and, you know, paid a price for it as well. I think, you know, Rocky's checkered history you know, for mental issues really stems back to Texas's draconian laws about marijuana possession and also to the band's avid experimentation with psychedelic drugs when they became available back in the 60s.
Right. And so tell me a little bit about these reissues. I understand that this covers Rocky Erickson's solo career, and I mean, how much does it have to do with 13th Floor Elevators?
Well, the Elevators basically ended, fell apart, and that's certainly came to an end when Rocky was incarcerated in the Rusk Institution for the Criminally Insane, and which is where it was. It basically was a way to avoid prison time for his second pot possession charge. And there he underwent things like electroshock therapy. It was a pretty rough period. And when he emerged, this was all oak. And in fact, part of my curiosity and excitement about doing, getting the opportunity to do these liner notes is I was involved along with several folks, Darren Bissett, Kirby McDaniel and Doug Hannerson started up a fanzine called Not Fade Away. We really did, over several interviews, the first public interviews with Rocky after he'd gotten out of Rusk. And, you know, I think a year and a half, 2 years had gone by. But it was very interesting because he seemed relatively lucid considering what he'd been through. And that led through in 75, his first recordings, which came out of his first public performances at the Ritz Theater in Austin. And that, in fact, is part of the third album of this reissue. Gremlins Have Pictures. There are some of those very crude live recordings. But shortly afterwards, through Doug Somm, Rocky started recording again with his band, new band Bleep Alien, which basically morphed into the Aliens. And Bill Miller, who was part of all three of these reissued recordings, was part of Bleep Alien that performed at the Ritz and then recorded a single for Mars Records, an independent label that sessions were produced by Doug Saab. And I was at those sessions. So a lot of this was, you know, things that I've remembered out of curiosity. And luckily for Bill, for me, Bill Bentley, who was supposed to write the liners and who works at Vanguard Five Records, has great history, did the reissue Pyramid Meets the Eye, which is the rock, not the reissue, but the Rocky Tribute album back in the 90s. Bill couldn't do these liners, and he recommended that I do it. And I talked with Lightning Records, and after negotiating basically a decent fee, I said, how long can I go? And they said, go as long as you want. So I figured, if I'm going to, I may write a book length. And I think in the end it was 15,000 words, which would be a thin book. But I got to really riff.
But no slouch. That's no slouch.
Well, I got to answer a lot of questions that I had along the way and learn stuff. In fact, it killed me that right before the first album, the last sessions for the first album were Rocky's vocals done in Austin. And he is incarcerated at the time in the Austin State Hospital. He's had a relapse. And they let him out during the day, and he goes to Lone Star Studios, which is where Austin Java is on 12th and Lamar, pretty much. And he's doing his vocals. And I forgot all about it.
Wait. They let him out to go do vocals?
Yeah. And his manager, Craig Luck, and his producer, Stu Cook, from Creedence Clearwater, were waiting at Lone Star Studios. And I'd forgotten all about it until Craig told me. I wrote an article about it in the Austin Statesman. And so I went back onto that. And so there was a lot of the past that I knew. And I basically just wanted to get the chronology right from post-Elevators all the way to the end of these recordings, which is about 1985. There were other recordings going on. And, I mean, stuff that was done on Holiday Inn room beds. Rocky was getting very prolific, but these were the best recordings made in a studio situation.
Right.
And of course, it was like pulling teeth, but, you know, you had Stu Cook of Creedence Clearwater and also Jack Cassidy of Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuner playing bass. You've got Billy Miller, who's constantly all the way through with his auto harp, and to me, that's the continuum of the jug sound, the unique jug sound that Tommy Hall created with the Elevators. So he's got this cool new layer of sound through the auto harp. and you've got Dwayne Ashlax, and he's just a killer rock and roll guitarist all through this. You have John Reed, who today is playing all around Austin and is kind of an all-star underground all-pro guitarist. He's known more as a rockabilly roots player. He's working and doing pre-production with Rocky. And it's just this very interesting period of he's been encouraged and indulged, and at the same time has to fight these relapses where he spins out of control and he gets institutionalized.
Right.
So it's an amazing story to get it done, and really for these recordings to stand on their own today, you know, this is 25 years later, even 30 years later, man, this is great stuff. So it was fun to get to go back and look at it and to see where Rocky's at today, that he gets to perform, plays concerts in Europe and all over the world, and is in fairly good shape. These recordings were pretty crucial in making this happen. So that was it was a blast for me to get to participate in.
How do these? What do you think Rocky Erickson's lasting legacy is?
Well, he's just this great rock and roll voice, first and foremost. And, you know, for Travis High School dropout, who was, you know, in the mid-60s, he was heavily influenced by Bob Dylan and Mick Jagger. But what I pick up through these recordings in particular, he was also very heavily influenced by Buddy Holly. And he was a continuum of West Texas rockabilly as much as he is psychedelic music and Texas psychedelic music. He's many things. So there's a lot of rockabilly in these recordings. And it's just this great shatter. He's, you know, which should not denigrate his guitar skills. He's a great guitarist. He's a real good straight ahead rock and roll guitarist, but just that voice. There are very few people that were so far out there and so distinctive that, you know, he was very heavily influenced by Little Richard and Little Richard's shouting style. And, you know, all that makes for when you look at a Texas rock and roll singer, yeah, we can talk about Tommy Duncan with Bob Wills with Texas Playboys or Buddy Holly, but from the 60s on, I throw down with Rocky. I mean, he is the great rock and roll voice of Texas, and he sounds like Texas. Even though a lot of these recordings that Lie in the Attic has reissued, they're all done in San Francisco. He's got so much Texas dripping over him. You know, we're over the top and excessive, and you know, just like the elevators probably took way too much acid. We do things way over the top, but it comes out, you know, nowhere else but Texas.
Right.
You know, and transfer the politics. Ted Cruz may not be any Wendy Davis, but we're really great blowhards, too. So, you know, and we're great preachers. I think it really is Rocky and Doug Somm in particular speak to me about why we're so great, because we're excessive and do things so well and so far over the top. Rocky's a synthesis of rockabilly and rock and roll and psychedelic, all these things. And, you know, when you get into demons and all these, you know, the work pictures that he started drawing in these recordings, I love it that one of the tracks, one of my favorite tracks to go back and listen to is I Walk with the Zombies, which is him ripping off of horror movies, but talk about freshness. You know, we're all about zombies. Zombies are hot today. They're in
that's
TV
for sure.
Commercials. They're in TV series and movies.
The Walking Dead.
And Rocky was way ahead of his time. So, you know, all I can say is it ain't bragging if it's true. And this is really great Texas rock and roll.
Well, let me ask you this question. I'm sure you're aware of the annual Psych Fest that happens here in Austin.
Sure.
How do you see the bridge from what Rocky Erickson did in the 60s to what these bands are doing now?
Well, the bridge between those to the present in the 60s, to me, the bridge is the late 70s, early 80s. And when punk and new wave broke out in Austin, kind of broke grip of either roots blues or you know, cosmic cowboy music. And blues are a really important part of all this. And Rocky's the blues man, but Rocky was the godfather of punk new wave scene in Austin. They broke out at Raoul's and kind of morphed into Duke's Royal Coach and then Club Foot. When he was playing, particularly with the Explosives, which, you know, which were kind of ringers. These guys had ties to Jerry Jeff Walker. They had, Freddie Kirch, who today is a great conservator of the 60s sound, Freddie Kirch. He was the drummer. And basically, Rocky was someone that all the punks and the new wavers had to look up to. He was the guy that had been around. He was the old pro. And you know, he really showed the way. So it was unlike many punk new wave scenes elsewhere in the United States. They didn't have an elder statesman or a mentor or godfather. And, you know, we had Rocky, and that was a big difference. So that continuum that to me was like late 70s, early 80s, just basically kept progressing into the 90s. And, you know, I think what the Butthole Surfers did, they were highly derivative and very deferential, all the way up to Okkervil River. And, you know, King Coffee's work from Butthole Surfers with keeping Rocky's flame alive, all through the 90s in his tore down period. What he is today is, you know, this continued, it never stopped.
Right.
The only interruption was his incarceration at Rusk, and he had a few rough patches. I mean, I think in the 90s when he was, you know, I went out and visited him in Del Valley, and, you know, he had all this white noise, he had all these TVs going at the same time. And he kind of descended into kind of a dark, mad period. He wasn't taking any antidepressants anymore. It was showing. But, you know, even at that tore down period, I remember going with him over to his mom's house where he grew up in South Austin, and he still played music. So, you know, he had a lot of people that helped him, King Coffee and Craig Stewart and Casey Monahan of Texas Music Office, Henry Rollins of Black Flag taking an interest in getting his literary work republished. Tom Warden, who lives in Taylor, he was with the Dirt Breakers. They were really instrumental in keeping Rocky alive and going explosive and pretty steady. We had people all along the way that had been, you know, wanted to respect him, wanted to honor him, and looked out for him. And, you know, even his brother Sumner, who had ended up, you know, they kind of split up. But if you saw the film doc, and Sumner basically fighting for custody, getting him on meds, getting him new teeth, and setting up a foundation, this really kind of led to Rocky's resurgence at the Ice Cream Socials at Threat Gills here in South by Southwest. And that has all led up to, you know, his role as being, you know, a very important figure in the Elder Statesman, the Sidecast.
Right on.
We've always been, you know, everybody gets, God bless San Francisco, but all that, so much of that was populated by Texans, whether it was the Elevators or the Sir Douglas Quintet or the Steve Miller Band, Chet Helms and Family Dog. I mean, the whole post-ring tradition that was really brought to the fore by Gilbert Shelton. But Chet Helms at the Family Dog, his uncle, he came from Texas. His uncle was a Holy Roller preacher. That's where he learned offset preaching and kind of birthed the poster thing. So Texans were a real important, Janis Joplin were a really important part of what happened in San Francisco. But it's always been our own thing here, too. And Rocky is that linear connection that it's never waned. And that started before San Francisco.
Well, Joe Nick Potosky, I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
Sure.
Well, that brings us to the end of our show. But before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our intro and outro music. And of course, I would also like to thank you for listening to our show. There are more episodes available for you at TexasObserver.org. We'll be back to talk to you next week on Observer Radio.